Once more under the bridge, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure.
Sorry, your mic was way too high. I had to turn it down, and then my mouth was away from the microphone, so...
You lost track of where your mouth was?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I misplaced my mouth.
Let's see. Welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure.
Yeah, there
we did
it.
A little bit awkward, but at least we got the job done.
That's just described my life.
Yeah, well, yeah, mine too. And I've had more experience of being awkward than you have. Hey, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's the name of a radio program, but it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that manages wealth for people. So that's why we call it a wealth management firm. And let's see what else. We advertise on KTEM, and they don't pay us to be on this radio program, but we don't pay them for the radio program.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else do we need to say?
We're educational.
We are not giving investment advice, despite the fact that we are the principals in a registered investment advisory firm. This is not investment advice. This is educational stuff. Educational information, and we have gotten that information from sources we believe to be reasonably reliable and accurate, things like the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and Financial Times and The Economist and things like that, that have a good reputation for either getting it right the first time or at least publishing a correction. But we don't make any warranties or guarantees as to the accuracy or completeness of the information that we present on this educational radio program. Seems like there's something else we ought to say.
No, we're done.
We're done?
Yep.
All right, we can go
That's
home
all.
Now. All right. Well, it was an interesting week in Lake Wobegon. No. It was an interesting week in the stock exchanges.
Yeah.
Wherever they were. In fact, it was such an interesting week that the S&P 500, the one that we follow more closely than we do other indices, crossed the 3,000 mark, which if it were the Dow would have made headlines, I guess, if crossing a round figure like that on Thursday. That was cool. At the end of the day on Thursday, it was over 3,000. But even cooler was the fact that on Friday it continued up. Didn't go up a whole lot on Friday, but and it only wound up rising 0.78% for the week, which is not an earth-shaking quantity in the big picture. It's up 7.58% from a year ago, which is about the average annual rise in the S&P 500 over its, I think, 100 and some years now that something that looks like the S&P 500 or its predecessor has been tracked. Nothing particularly special there. But there are a couple of special things going on. One of them is, if we finish out July, well, actually, at this point in July, if you want to measure from now, we have 121 months of economic expansion. And if we finish, this is the 121st month, and technically we got to wait till the end of July to get 121 months. But even at 120.4 months or whatever we're in, we now have the longest economic expansion since 1854 when we started keeping records on economic expansions in the United States. In other words, the GDP has risen consistently and not had two quarters of decline for 121 months. There's no evidence that it's going to decline in this month, so we're home free. That's pretty impressive. Now, the other side of that, of course, is the fact that the GDP has only risen at about 2.6% on average in this expansion, where the average of the last three expansions has been 3.6. So it's still not caught up to even the least of those expansions, even though it's been running longer. It's a lot of complicated information there, but this is really an old expansion, and it's really been a slow expansion. It's had the lowest inflation we've seen since we've been keeping records on such things, 1.6% for 10 years. And it's just chugging along. I mean, it's the market has been fairly consistent And it has run a long time in an upward direction, and now it's rolled up a little higher and broke records again. And, of course, the record-breaking rise that we just saw, where we broke all records, was preceded by investors being scared and pulling $30 billion out of equity mutual funds.
Right. So the market was up on non-amateur investors.
Right. The amateur investors are trying to pull it down because they're scared, which is a good sign for a bull market.
Yeah. It means that people are still worried. And we're seeing a lot of worry now. I mean, we've been talking about a recession for a while. So have a lot of economists. We're doing our job. We're trying to say, hey, remember, bad times come too. That's caused a lot of pessimism in a bull market, which is kind of a good thing. It means the longer people are pessimistic about their investments going forward, the more careful they are about what they put their money into, the better the scenario. Because the investments that have had a lot of research done into them are not always.
Or you can say it very simply.
Generally, they are better investments.
Think John Templeton, in a bull market climbs a wall of worry.
Right. And that is absolutely true.
And speaking of walls of worry, we have a telephone call on 25. I didn't give the telephone number.
We didn't.
Yeah, 254-773-1400. And somebody read my mind and is called in on 254-773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was going to ask you a question. When there's a war involved, why is it that, even though the citizens aren't involved in it, but they live in the country that the war's happening, United States, Iraq, or whatever, why is it that that affects the stock market, the economy, everything, just affects everything? It's just a question. You have a good day.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for the call.
That's actually a pretty good question.
Yeah. Because, I think it's a common sense on one extreme. One extreme of that answer is if you're at war, it may be your country will disappear in this war. So that's one extreme. And then you have the other extreme, which is you have a superpower of the world getting involved in a conflict in a tiny, as far as wealth goes or as far as armed forces go, country. So why would going to war affect that superpowers market? Why would going to war affect the smaller countries market? Well, I think it's pretty obvious why it would affect the smaller countries market. What do you think?
It's kind of an understatement that it's going to affect the smaller countries market. It might disappear. They do outside of the United States.
Right.
But the big thing in the United States is initially, if we were to suddenly go to war with Iran, let's for example,
right,
the market would plunge.
Yeah.
I'm quite confident. And then cooler heads, and that'd be the amateurs bailing out, by the way.
Yeah.
And the cooler heads would prevail and say, whoa, is this ever going to be a boon to the defense industry? And a lot of money is going to be spent, and a lot of profits are going to be made, and then the market would go back up.
Right. The initial reaction to war is always, whoa, this is scary, and I don't think I don't know what. That is the synopsis of the thought. So there's no conclusion to that thought. But a lot of people, when they feel that way, that uncertainty amplified by some strong emotion, they act. And in the case of many people in the market, when wars happen, the market drops. So here's an interesting kind of a derivative of that question. On September 11, 2001, World Trade Center, New York City, was that an existential threat to the United States?
All depends on whether you're in one of the Twin Trade Towers.
Right. To the country as a whole, it was a minor event if you consider it percentage-wise.
Economically, right.
Just thinking economics, thinking purely if everyone were absolutely rational. So what the underlying to that is not the way people actually think. So if you look at it from the purely statistical standpoint, 9/11 wasn't even a big deal. It was 1/10 of the people that were killed on the highways. Now, if you're talking emotionally, and that's why people make decisions in the market most of the time, is based on emotion. It was a big deal emotionally. It was like being slapped in the face. That does not make you die unless you're slapped by a very large person. Being slapped in the face is embarrassing. It's painful. It's shameful. but it shouldn't affect whether or not your heart functions unless you've got some other serious problem. So when we're talking about war, the emotions of war are the big danger when we're talking about going to war, say, with Iran or with Afghanistan or when we went to Iraq. Any of those events, I don't think anybody said, well, this is the end of the United States. There's no way we can survive this.
There's some people who did probably think it was the end of the United States.
I will say that they were probably pretty rare.
Right now, for example, the you can tell by whether people buy or sell stock at a given moment whether they're Democrats or Republicans.
Not completely, I know what you're saying.
As a group. In other words, you can say that the people who President Trump ratchets up tensions with Iran or China or something and the market drops, and you look at who, not so much China, but with Iran, the market drop, and I read an article on this, is about 80% generated by Democrats.
Yeah.
And when the Republicans, the people who support President Trump, see him doing something like that, he says, oh, this is going to be great. It's going to make us better and bigger
right.
and stronger. And they tend to buy stocks at
right.
that moment. So there's some degree of...
There's politics in the market.
There's a high level of silliness.
Yeah, because the reality is that a day-to-day political opinion on how we do a camp on the border has no impact on the profitability of Facebook or Apple or you name another American corporation. Who would that have a profitability issue with? Well, maybe the people that are selling the stuff to the government to make the camp. But people tend to vote with their dollars. That's not necessarily a good thing for them long term, but it is a fact of life. It's a reality. We have to deal with that reality.
To give an example of how things change, I can easily remember 20 years ago, a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico would cause the stock market to drop and the price of oil to jump like 20%.
Right.
Well, the price of oil went from $57 to $60.
Because
we have a hurricane in the Gulf.
Right.
And the market went up.
Right.
Despite the fact that the hurricane is going to cause, let's say the hurricane comes ashore and it causes great devastation and a lot of things are destroyed. Historically, we've actually seen where that would cause the market to sag. It didn't. It actually caused the market to go up because we've learned a few things.
Yeah, we've got different fears, different threats that are the motivators. We're not as afraid of some external event affecting the price of oil, so it doesn't affect the price of oil.
But we are afraid of some internal event affecting the price of bonds.
Yes, and stocks. So we're seeing less volatility in the oil market because there's more trading, there's more volume going on. And one of the things that been training my understudy at the office, and one of the things that I tell him is that volatility, that's bumpiness. It can't just be looked at as itself. You have to see what is being volatile. If it's a company that trades very rarely, we call that thinly traded. They're going to be more volatile. Every trade is going to have a bigger swing. And if it's a company that has a lot of trades, you're not going to see as much volatility. And with oil, we're seeing the same thing. There's more volume. There's more volume of oil means there's less bumpiness in the price of oil. And we have another caller.
Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There was an article early this week about a new piece of legislation called the Secure Act.
Mm-hmm.
The tagline is Secure Act would upend 20 years of retirement planning and stick it to the middle class. What is the Secure Act? Is there anything we can do to plan for it, or do we just bend over and assume the position?
This is a family radio program.
Yes. Do you want me to start? You start.
I don't know. Whichever you want to flip.
Okay. The Secure Act, which just as a side note, it's a silly acronym. Let me see if I can find what it stands for. it's pretty silly. It's like here we go. This probably has it. The Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement Act of 2019. So the title doesn't really make sense. They just wanted the acronym to be secure.
It's such a nice acronym.
Right. So they just said, it doesn't matter. Throw some words in there that start with these letters. So the very first problem with this bill, it's not a law yet. The House of Representatives passed it nearly unanimously in May. And the Senate had a similar bill that they were sitting on. And the Senate version of the House bill has been held up by our Senator Ted Cruz for reasons that have really nothing to do with this bill. So what does the bill say? Well, it's dealing with retirement accounts. So there's a series of things that it's doing. Number one, it's allowing groups of businesses to get together to make a retirement plan, and they don't have to be related to each other by industry. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's a good thing. All right, that's a good thing. That brings some costs down. You can share it with other people. Does it have anything wrong with it? Yes. Yes, there are some things that are wrong with it. What if one of those other businesses goes out of business? You're still sharing the services of the 401k with former employees of a company that doesn't exist anymore. So there's some nuanced problems with that. The front end of it has a lot of good stuff on it, but they definitely need to write the back end of it better. What another thing does it say? This is a big one. Removing postponing the date at which you must pull money out of your retirement account. So if you've got an IRA, if you're in a 401k and you're not working anymore, the government says to you, this year you have turned 70 and one half. Yes, they use the one half here too. So the government and five-year-olds, I have a 4.5-year-old daughter, and she's very proud of the half year. The government is also proud of half years. The only other people are four and five-year-olds that count half years.
Wait a minute, actuaries?
And the IRS.
Actuaries work off of half years.
Okay. So they're moving, at least in the House version, the Senate original version had the year 70, the age 75. The House has said age 72. It was originally 70 and a half. This is the year, the age that the government says, hey, you've been putting money into this IRA. It is pre-tax. You've never paid us any taxes on this money. So you must start taking it out and paying taxes on it. And they do it based on a table that has life expectancies in it, which is not, in my opinion, also a good descriptor. It should be the death expectancy. But if it's life expectancy, we should be measuring to the next birth. If it's death expectancy, then we're measuring to death. So death expectancy tables are wrapped up in here. The size of your portfolio, the amount of return that they kind of generally expect the world to have. And they want you to have $0 left when you're dead.
When you're statistically dead.
Yes. And if you take your time getting statistically dead, they keep ratcheting up the amount that you need to take out until eventually you've got to take 100% out. And that's, I think, after age 118.
In other words, if you live too long, they want you to be broke.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
So moving back the initial start date of that, it's great. That's fine. It means that people that are still working, there are people that are working later, that are enjoying their life and don't want to take money out if they're working later and don't need it. They don't have to take it. It's not necessarily the best choice, but that's something that has to be individualized. We really have to do some calculations to see the best effect of doing anything with a retirement account. Okay, what else? Well, the reason why a required minimum distribution exists is because the government wants to be paid taxes. And we're getting less revenue now with the taxes being cut than we were before. And Congress is very aware of this. So how do they pay for moving back that RMD age? And the answer is they change how retirement accounts are taxed after death. This is the big one, and people say this is the hidden part of the Secure Act. It's not hidden.
It's not very well hidden.
It's not right hidden at all. No, it's not hidden. It's in every headline of every major publication
it's
right
now. It's a dramatic tax increase on your beneficiaries.
No hidden part of it at all. Maybe they hid it by calling it secure, but I guess it's a secure tax increase. Basically, what happens today? Do you want to explain this part, or do you want me to?
Okay. Go ahead. Basically, previously, if you die and you've got a bunch of money in your IRA, now there's details that can change this, but bottom line to it is if you die, let's say you died at 65 and you had a whole bunch of money in your IRA and it went to your children.
Not to your wife. If it goes to your spouse,
spouse, nothing changes. It's her IRA.
Right.
Just, or his IRA.
It just becomes as if it was theirs all along.
But if it goes to the children.
Or anyone else for that matter.
Then what happens is the way the money automatically comes out is based on their life expectancy, and they, let's just say they have, according to the tables, they have 60 years left to live. Well, they have to take out 1/60th
of the money the first year. There's a little bit more than 1/60th because they're looking at
There's a divisor there.
Right.
But anyway, the bottom line to it is, Your dependents, your heirs, your beneficiaries on your IRA can start taking out the money at a very, very, very slow speed so that it will, in essence, annuitize over their lifetime. Now, that means that it's called a stretch IRA before the law put it into effect.
Right. Either called stretch IRA or inherited IRA, beneficiary IRA. There's a lot of names for it.
But it was called the plan before we actually had a law that said it was this way. It was a very convoluted way you could do it. So then Congress, under the Republicans, years ago, passed a law that says, hey, automatic stretch IRA. You can your beneficiaries can stretch out the income from the IRA over their lifetime.
Which is great, because before that we had a 3-year, 5-year, 10-year, and there was another time when it was the life expectancy of the dead person. See if you get that one right.
Well, it still is if the dead person has already started taking RMDs.
No, they've changed that.
They changed that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, now the current rate is the life expectancy of the beneficiary, unless it was started under the old law when it was the life expectancy of a dead person, which, yeah, just
it's
that's
a little
just
complicated.
It's the government.
But the bottom line to it is a tax advantage to your beneficiaries. Well, guess what? It's not that way anymore. You got to take it out over a 10-year period at max. That's the maximum length of time that you have to take it out.
That's in this new law.
That's in the new law that
it's not been passed yet. It's not been passed yet.
And there's another aspect to this law that I object to strongly. And that is the ability to put a fixed annuity, an insurance company's product, in the 401k and have you invest in a fixed annuity. And the law specifically prohibits the Department of Labor or anybody else from regulating the commission rates or the expenses in this fixed annuity. Boy, a fixed annuity is probably the single most expensive or one of the most expensive retirement options you can possibly get. Theoretically, the insurance company will guarantee you some minimum rate of return over your lifetime if they stay in business. But unlike the mutual funds that are typically in IRAs, there is no Investment Company Act of 40 to protect your assets against bankruptcy there. It becomes a bit of a nightmare. And it basically, the Secure Act was heavily funded by lobbyists
From the insurance industry
who wanted to be able to sell high commission annuities, high profitability annuities into retirement plans and have people lock into those when they retired. They're basically the equivalent of a pension. And if the annuity company goes out of business, there's no backup insurance policy like there is with a pension plan. There's no federal insurance policy. There's no law protecting it from the bankruptcy proceedings as there is with a mutual fund, but they do get some huge commissions, and that is the driving force behind this bill.
There's more about this, but we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. No, you're not. All right. Another thing that it's doing, there are some pieces in here that are golden, that are amazing. This is just like most laws. You're going to have some really amazingly nice stuff in here and some really, really horrible, nasty stuff in here. One of the amazing things, penalty-free withdrawals from retirement plans for individuals in the case of birth or adoption. So if you were working while in the womb and you're born, you're allowed to that's not what it was at all. Not that. If you're about to have a kid and you have a lot of medical expenses, it's amazing. I just did this. There are a lot of medical expenses with birth. This new act it's not actually been passed again, would allow you to take penalty-free withdrawals from your IRA. Now, that's fantastic. If you have a Roth IRA, that's extra, extra fantastic. But when it comes to a traditional IRA, you're saving that 10% penalty. You can already do it for your first-time home buying. And by the way, this is another great governmental thing. You know this definition, right? First-time home buyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What is the definition of a first-time home?
The first time they actually purchase a home with a mortgage, isn't it?
No. No, it's the first time in the last 5 years.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Years. So first time means something different for the government than it does for the rest of us. But that's all right. It doesn't say first time child. It just says if you have a child or are adopting a child. So that's some pretty cool stuff.
I don't know that it's cool. I'm going to disagree here. Retirement account, if you want to save money, you want to put aside money in savings and say, hey, I'm going to have a kid. And we need to save up some money in advance because we're going to have a kid. Good. Wonderful idea. But the purpose in an IRA and the purpose in a 401k, the purpose in a retirement plan is to fund retirement. And life expectancies keep going up, and we have this massively underfund. Every article and study I've read says when people hit retirement, the vast majority of people don't have enough money to retire.
Right. Yeah.
So we're going to take out money really early on from a plan, and every time if you take $100 out of a retirement plan when you're 30, you've probably taken the equivalent of $700 or $800 out of your retirement fund when you took the $100 out. And by the way, yes, there's no 10% penalty, but the government does get its full income taxes on it.
Yeah. So you just hit on a policy point. What is the responsibility of government here? What is the responsibility of the individual investor? The individual investor chose to do an IRA or a 401k and then rolled it into an IRA. And there's some complicated things around that. Some of that is the way you get compensated by your employer. Maybe you got some extra money in your 401k that's above what you would normally get. So there's extra restrictions on this. So the question is, should the government have a penalty to you for withdrawing your money, period? And the reason, I know the reason for the penalty. They're saying, hey, we're going to try to disincentivize you from taking money out of this before you're old enough to retire. The question is, why are they picking and choosing? So they've got some things in here. If there's a medical catastrophe, you can do it. If you have a disability, you can do it. So there's a series of things. If you're going to school, you can do it. If you are a first-time home buyer, you can do it. So now we're adding more complexity to these things. You have a very valid objection to say, why are you allowing people to take money out of their retirement account for a birth?
Or for a home purchase.
And the reality is, why should the government be the one that says you can or you can't? And
well,
it's a question. I'm not saying that they shouldn't or they should. Why should they?
The government has never said you can't take the money out. The government has said you owe us taxes.
Plus a penalty.
The government has said you owe us taxes on your income. We will defer those taxes if you're using the money for something that we want you to use it for.
Right.
And then that was good. Because it's important because people, when they enter old age, in some cases, wind up on Medicaid and they wind up with SSI. They basically are in the position where when they get old, there's a general consensus in the United States, we can't let them starve to death. Now, if you encourage people when they're younger...
Wait. When they're old, we have that general consensus. If they're old, we can't let them starve to death. But we have the same general consensus when they're babies. We don't want them to starve to death either. So the general consensus is we really don't want people starving to death.
But the point is a person can stop putting money into their IRA or stop putting money into their 401k when they have a baby, and that gives them extra cash flow to deal with the baby.
If they have a job.
You got a point.
So there are some issues here of the government's trying to put some nuances in.
Well, if they don't have a job, then the 10% tax penalty probably won't be a significant event.
It may or may
not.
Because
they don't have any income.
It may or may not be. We don't. And that's kind of the point, is that this piece by itself, okay, you can take a penalty-free withdrawal of your own money. Still have to pay taxes on it, but it's penalty-free and it's your money. There are lots of studies on this, and this is why I'm bringing it up. There are actual psychological and behavioral economic studies on whether or not you leave money in something because it has penalties for taking it out if it's completely voluntary. And what they found is that people voluntarily put penalties on products so that they don't touch them.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to do it, we should just do it. Let the government do it and then say, hey, there's a penalty if you take it out, period. There's no reason why you should take it out, so don't. Your house is not your retirement. Your kid is not your retirement. Stop it. That's the original law.
And that is actually true in pension plans.
Right. In pension plans, you can't. I'm buying a house. Well, that's nice to know.
It's too bad. The money's in the pension plan. It's for your pension. It's right. Not for your buying a house.
So, and we're not saying that pensions are well run, because they're not. But this is one area that you can take a loan from a lot of 401ks, and that is one of the worst things you can do to your 401k. It's just really, 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 and I can underline that, italics, bold, whatever you want. I'll put air quotes around it so that you can see all of the other air formatting that I'm doing.
All right.
To this, it's bad for your 401k to take a loan from it. You still have the right to do it. Why do you have the right to do it?
Because somebody wanted to make something attractive to get themselves some votes.
Okay, and I'm kind of even afraid to say you have the right to do it, because that's a right that can be very easily taken away.
Well, it's not even the issue is borrowing your own money. Now, what's the purpose in borrowing your own money?
It's a good question. And some people see it as, well, this is a less interest than I would pay in taxes if I were to take a withdrawal.
But they can't take if it's a 401k.
They can't take a withdrawal.
You can't take a loan from a IRA, and you can from a 401k.
Some 401ks.
But you can't take the money out of the 401k until you leave employment. So it's a convoluted mess is what it is.
And that is the point that I'm coming to, is that we're adding something with the Secure Act. It's giving some more abilities to do some things and taking some abilities to do other things away, and it's adding a level of complexity to sections of the law that have never been simplified. The 401k was not intended to be a retirement plan.
No.
It was utilized by an attorney who said, hey, I bet we could use this to do that. And then through court cases, the court said, yeah, you can do that. And so the IRS has given us some phenomenally complex rules on how to do a 401k, because that's not what the law was intended mm-hmm. to do. So, and then we've added pieces of law that affect that original law that wasn't intended to do this thing, to put nuances on a thing it wasn't intended to do. You can understand why this is a full employment opportunity for retirement specialists forever. Let's just simplify it.
Now, there's one aspect to the Secure Act that is superbly a good idea. And that is the fact that it doesn't have anything to do with retirement plans. It has to do with the fact that in the Secure Act is a provision that allows what are called, I don't remember the name they've unofficially given, but basically children of people who have been killed in combat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right now, when they receive money, it's taxed entirely to them, and because of a kitty tax provision.
It's taxed at the trust
rates.
The
Tax Reform Act of 1986, it's taxed basically if you have a child and your spouse gets killed in combat, the money that comes to the child as a benefit, which comes in monthly, is taxed as if the child were a multibillionaire. It is like 37% tax rate almost immediately on what they get because of the way that law is set up. And that is part of the Secure Act, is fixing that. It's a, what's called a sweetener. Nobody is going to object to that except Ted Cruz. And
no, he's objecting to it because the Senate bill that's being passed is missing a piece that was in the House bill.
No, they're passing the exact House bill, but it was in the original Senate bill. It was dropped from the House bill when they passed it. They sent it. The House bill was originally passed, sent to the Senate, didn't go anywhere. It came back to the House. Nancy Pelosi brought it up with some modifications to make it passable in the Senate. And one of the things that made it passable in the Senate was to remove the ability of homeschoolers to use 529 funds to pay for homeschool expenses.
Yeah. So that was in the bill at the beginning when it passed the Ways and Means Committee. But when it got to the floor vote, that was pulled out. And now Ted Cruz is saying, we're not going forward without this. We must use 529s to pay for homeschooling as well. Okay, so this is a different subject. 529s. 529s are some kind of a weird monstrosity between the states and the federal government. The state has to set up a college fund program, and they can choose different mutual funds. They can choose different expenses. There's all kinds of different choices that each state level can do, but they generally have one official plan. So there's 50 plans out there that fall under the 529 category. The way they work is that you put this money toward your child's education or your own education, and then when it comes time, you can pull the money out. You haven't paid taxes on the gains in the process. It's not deductible to put it in there, but you don't have taxes on the gains when you pull it out, so long as you're using it for the right educational purposes. So what it had been traditionally is college, post-secondary education. Well, in the Tax Reform and Jobs Act of 2017, they changed that to say you can take it out for private high schools, private schools, period. So if your kid goes to a preschool, is going to a high-quality school, it can't be a daycare, it's got to be a school, then you can take money out of this 529 and use it to pay the school.
Now qualifying expense.
Qualifying expense. This is a new qualifying expense. But you can't do that if you're homeschooling. You can do it if you're sending to a private school. Okay, well, the reason is because it's really hard in the homeschooling side of things to prove that it's an educational expense. It's really easy if you're going to school. This is tuition. At homeschool, you could be using it to buy cornflakes. You could be, is that a school purchase? Well, you could argue that it is.
Or you could use it to buy a new car and say,
use it for field trips.
Yeah.
Right. So the government just said, man, that's an audit potential. The Congress said, we're not even going to mess with that. The Democrats don't like homeschool anyway, which I find amazing because it has nothing to do with quality. It's just this is a political belief that everything should be public. Quality, I think, trumps any of the other, and Trump is not an intended pun.
It works.
All right. So that's the Secure Act. If it passes the Senate, and it may not pass the Senate this year because they don't have time to do the full floor vote. They were trying to pass it through what it's called unanimous consent. That means nobody says no. All it takes is one of the 100 to say, hey, I don't want this. And they have to go through the whole floor vote, which includes lots of debate. And Senator McConnell has said this is the schedule for the Senate, and we're concentrating on getting judges in. We're trying to get them approved, and judges take a long time. Even though we don't have a filibuster on judges, there's sometimes 40 hours of debate per vote, and we've got hundreds of votes on judges. So McConnell is saying, well, if we don't do it this way, then the law doesn't pass, this year at least. So that's where it is.
And odds are, by the way, when the Senate comes back from, well, among other things this year, there's this little problem I want to talk about later. We need to do commercials. But there's a little problem I want to talk about, the fact that Secretary Mnuchin has warned.
Oh, yeah. We may not have enough money.
When they go into recess, we may run out of money before they come back from recess.
Right. The August recess doesn't end until almost all the way the end of September.
And we don't have a budget.
And we don't have a budget passed, and the debt ceiling hasn't been raised, and what has been passed for spending is likely going to exceed that ceiling.
And so what do we need to do? Ted Cruz effectively killed the Secure Act.
Yeah. So let's play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. Talking politics is no fun, but sometimes we have to understand it to make plans for our own retirement. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
I believe in you. Just four simple words, but to a child in need, they mean the world. I believe in you means you have potential. You are special. You matter. When you become a child sponsor with Save the Children, you're saying, I believe in you. You are smart. You're capable. You will overcome obstacles that most can't imagine. Your sponsorship says to a child, I believe that you deserve a successful start to life and a solid foundation to build upon. I believe you're worthy of good nutrition, quality health care, and the opportunity that education unlocks. Becoming a Save the Children sponsor sends a powerful message of support. It says, I am here for you, to lift you up, to cheer you on, and to celebrate your success. Because when you believe in a child, you empower them to believe in themselves. I believe in you. Just four simple words that can bring hope, that can change a life. Visit sponsor.savethechildren.org today and tell a child in need, I believe in you.
Of course my kid's in the right car seat. Well, I think he is.
Yeah, my kid's in a booster seat. He was ready to move up. He is ready, right?
Her car seat looks like the right size.
There are probably rules on when to move up to a booster seat, aren't there?
Rear-facing, forward-facing? I think I have it right.
Car crashes are a leading killer of children 1 to 13. Are your children in the right car seat for their age and size? Don't think you know. Know you know. Go to safercar.gov/the right seat.
I know my child's in the right car seat, or else I wouldn't get in the driver's seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We got it right.
We did.
Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. Now, that presumes that this is Saturday the 13th. Friday the 13th fell on a Saturday in June of 2019. And if it's some other date, you can call in here.
Wait a minute. You said June.
July. You're right.
Yeah.
July 13th.
Yeah, we're losing
track of time and space. Well, our brain...
Don't adjust the horizontal.
Yeah, anyway. Okay, it's July 13th. And remember, in July of 2019, Friday the 13th fell on a Saturday. And if it is that Saturday, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. And that should confuse things. And remember that this, the S&P 500, and this is a memorable position. We said in the newsletter last September, at the end of last September, this is an important number, 2929. You can remember that. This is where it was. And by the way, it was very close to its peak at 2930.75, I think. Which, interestingly enough, despite the fact we just broke a record in the S&P 500, is only 2.9% higher at 3,000 than it was at 2929.
Right. Records, when they come very incrementally, they're not that big a deal anymore.
Yeah, you got it.
All right. Well, you were talking about Mnuchin and the debt ceiling.
Yeah, we're going to run out of money. Interesting little tidbit of factoid that doesn't seem to be very important anymore is the fact that the federal deficit is up 23% over where it was this time last year. In other words, in a one-year time period, the federal deficit has risen. No, I'm sorry. Year to date, it's up 23% compared, and it has risen. Get this. The federal deficit has risen 23% since the beginning of the year compared with last year. 23%. That's a big number. Revenues are indeed up. We cut taxes, and the theory was that revenues would rise and it would make up for the difference, and that's really neat. And revenues are up a whopping 3%. Unfortunately, government spending is up 7%, and we're still not spending all the money that was allocated. Apparently, the Defense Department got way more money than they knew what to do with, and they're still trying to figure out how to spend it. And that's an interesting thing about the Tax Act, the ACA, what is it called?
It was the Jobs Reform and Tax Act, or no, Tax Reform and Jobs Act.
Whatever it was, yeah. Anyway, the act is that they was very politically popular at that point to throw a lot of money at the Defense Department, and they did. And that was last year. And the Defense Department is still trying to figure out how to spend all the money that they got. Now, why are they having so much trouble figuring out how to spend the money? Because Congress put ear tags on that money and said, you can't spend it on this and you can't spend it on that and you must spend it on this thing over here. And the Army and the Navy and the Air Force are saying, yeah, well, we don't really need this thing over here that you told us we had to spend money on.
So we'd rather spend it over here, but you didn't approve it for over here. You approved it for over there.
We'd rather spend it on maintenance and training on what we have, but I realize that, Congressman, that's not in your home district that the maintenance and training goes on there for. So politics as usual continues. Only the point is we're borrowing a pretty phenomenal quantity of money. We're on track for this fiscal year to be over $900 billion. That's $1 trillion in deficit, nearly $1 trillion in deficit, if we don't have a slowdown, if everything continues to run well in the economy. And sometimes I think that you and I are the only two people who are in the least concerned about the fact that we're borrowing $1 trillion a year.
Yeah. I mean, people remember back in 2009 when we were saying TARP is a good idea, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Remember that $700 billion? Use it. The government's going to get a positive return on this. It's going to be phenomenal. And it was. The government wound up making about $250 billion off of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and it only used about $350 billion to do it with. It nearly doubled its money. People thought we were advocating for just borrowing everything. But the reality is that it's a really, really good idea to borrow within reason when your economy is in bad shape to pull yourself out of it. It's a really, really bad idea to borrow lots when your economy is in great shape, especially if what you're borrowing for isn't going to increase the future's economy. It will just increase your district's economy a little bit this year. If you're not putting back into stuff that creates revenue for the future, you're in trouble.
Now, there's an interesting thing going on in the stock market that is counterintuitive. Earnings in the first and second quarter of the S&P 500 were down from the year before, which constitutes what's called an earnings recession.
Mm-hmm.
It looks very much like the earnings for this quarter, meaning the, as we look back, the second quarter, the first quarter was down. The second quarter is almost certainly going to, let me rephrase that. It's almost certainly going to be down based on the advance warning that we've gotten from corporations, which means we got an earnings recession. Folks, we had a big tax cut.
Yeah, it's no big surprise that we're not going to have the same kind of boost in earnings that we had when the earnings were from not having to pay taxes.
But this is
that doesn't increase every year.
We had a 10-year tax cut that's minimally going to cost $1.5 trillion for the government. And I hate to say this, but all the positive effects of said tax cut are now behind us.
Yes. Well,
we had 1 year of positive effect.
And it was good. It was a very good positive effect. It it boosted a lot of investment, not as much as we wanted it to boost. We wanted it to boost a lot more on the corporate investment front. Well, but then we had the trade war, and that has the opposite effect on investment. It dampens it. So instead it was used to buy shares back, which caused the stock market to go up. But earnings now are diluted across larger the earnings have to be diluted. And in doing so, it lowers some of the revenue.
Well, actually, they concentrated because there's fewer shares out there. The earnings are being
concentrated.
You're right.
It's not diluted. It's concentrated.
We got 1 year benefit from the tax cut. Now, I will have to say, several economists that I've read have said the tariffs, as they stand today, not with no increases, have almost perfectly offset the advantages of the tax cut financially and economically.
Only now the advantages are behind us and the trade war is still going, so we may have the opposite.
The ongoing effect of having lower taxes, which should cause faster growth, has been almost perfectly offset by the total economic effect of the tariffs. And because of the psychological effects in addition, there's a lot of complexities, and we're almost out of time for the hour. But I want to say this. It turns out that one of the fundamental reasons that the bond market says we're looking for trouble, earnings are down, but the stock market is up, is a very good reason. Companies are buying a lot of their own shares, which increases the earnings per share, which makes the share look good, and makes the shareholders more wealthy. So what we had in the tax cut, the value of the tax cut that we had at the end of 2017, the Tax Reduction and Jobs Act, I think, Tax Reform and Jobs Act, is flowing mainly to the shareholders of corporations.
Which is great. That's who we are. It's who our clients are. But it's not what the intention was, or at least the stated intention.
Right.
It's not the stated intention of Congress or the president. So
it's not hurting bonds either, because as interest rates come down, bond values go up.
It's just a heads up to know that we altered the system. Now the altered system is the status quo. We can't expect it to be – it's not a more efficient engine. That's the thing, is that it's roughly the same efficiency.
Well, but the same efficiency, but where's the money coming from that is producing the 3%? When we talk about – The tariffs, who are they hitting?
The buyers. They're hitting us.
They're hitting
consumers.
The people who shop at Walmart.
Right. And we've got to break for a hard break. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we've got voicemail available locally at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter, read our philosophy, listen to recordings of the radio program going back quite a few years. Check what we were saying a few years ago. If you'd like to contact us directly, it's jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.